Episode 29, September 8th.
Where was I? What's most difficult for me is trying to decide what to tell you and what not to. But I guess I have a while yet before you're
based
old enough to even understand these
podcasts.
They're more for me at this point, just so that I can get it straight. Should I tell you about
13?
Boy, that's a tough one. Will it affect your decision to send him here, knowing that
they do 50?
If you don't send Kyle, you could never be. God, a person could go crazy thinking about this. I suppose I will tell you. I owe him that. Maybe it'll help if you know that in a few hours that
they fucked around. They found out
a lifetime's worth.
Usted es muy hermosa, señora, y tengo pena decirle que me da $5, pero si no, mi padre me va a pegar.
What did he just say? Pretty good hustle, kid. Cuatro.
Sí, sí. Gracias. Miren, miren. Allá, viene una tormenta.
What did he just say?
He said there's a storm coming in.
I know.
Dope Movies and Shows, aka DMS, and I am your host, Nat. With me, as always, is Sir Hemingford Gray. How you doing, bud?
I hear you have a bit of the brewer's flu. What is brewer's flu, Hobbit?
Brewer's flu is more commonly known as the hangover.
Ah, okay. So that's what it is. No, I'm not hungover. But I am sick. Every single week, I start doing this show, and I'm like, oh man, I'm sick for the show. And then next week, the same thing happens. And I think I've come to realize I'm always sick. I just always am sick. What is going on? I think it's just the air quality. That's what it must be. By the way, Hobbit is also here. You might remember him from RoboCop, the Apocalypse episode. I really loved that episode. You know, I re-listened to that when we published it. And man, that was so much fun to record with you. And here we are again to talk to everyone about dystopias. And we're going to be talking about Soylent Green and Logan's Run. So these are some films I've never seen before. I'm seeing these for the very first time. They're both 70s sci-fi. I know them both by reputation. I think you guys have seen them before. Hobbit, you're going to chime in every once in a while when we get something wrong. But Hem, you've seen these a bunch before. And we're gonna be able to contrast those takes really well. We've got a bevy of takes for you. So let's dive in to Soylent Green. So do you remember the opening of this movie, Hemingford?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I didn't expect to get a Cheers vibe, as in the TV show Cheers, from the opening of Soylent Green. So for those who haven't seen it, there's like a Ken Burns effect over like sepia tone images from like the 1930s and stuff. And I thought this was like a dystopia film, and here we got like some piano music over some Ken Burns. But what you realize really quick, something that, you know, I got a double whammy of surprise. What you start to realize is they're showing the buildup of modernity. They're showing the Industrial Revolution. So first they start off by displaying pictures of photos of pioneers, and then trolley cars, steamboats, the gold
Industrial Revolution. Devolution, more like.
What? Then we got automobiles, airplanes, cities, metropolises, oil fields. You see women lined up at typewriters in offices, and it all the images are flying by now faster and faster. We're going through now the 60s and 70s where things are getting just completely fucked up. And that brings us to the time of the filming. I believe this was 1973. Because the film takes place in 2022. And right now we're 200 years into American history, the beginning of the country. And we actually are joining our characters in the context of the film about 50 years later. It takes place in New York City. And New York City has a population of 40 million people in this story.
What is the current population of New York City?
In reality, in 2022, it'll probably have about 9 million people. Right now, it has about 8.5 million.
Oh, so that would be pretty crowded then, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
That would be pretty crowded
then,
wouldn't it?
Crazy. I mean, New York City is a really crowded city. It is one of the most, I think it might be like the 10th most densely populated city in the world.
I think London's usually up there in the top 10, isn't it? London's pretty packed.
It's close, yeah. But I don't think it's quite as bad as New York. And you know what? Asian cities just absolutely have New York beat.
But at least they do it efficiently, though, don't they?
They do, right. They are able to handle their crime rates and whatnot without creating a police state. Whereas London and New York, they have crime problems and police state problems. So that's just fantastic. They have the best of both worlds. Yeah, but we open up the film with a commercial for a new product from the Soylent Corporation called Soylent Green. And it's actually,
yeah.
I didn't know this, but it's actually part of a whole lineup of Soylent products, each named after a color. So there's Soylent Red, Soylent Yellow, etc. I think that's a pretty neat product naming strategy. I think people had a good sensibility for this stuff in the 60s and 70s.
So a bit like Monster.
Oh, Monster.
Like Monster energy drinks?
Yeah, so like Soylent is kind of like the same sort of coloring scheme as Monster, and it's just like there's no sort of nods to any real food it might be, just like not monsters, no real...
Just gave up my diet. Monster Green is boomers.
I was going to say, is Monster White made out of ghosts?
Well, Soylent Green isn't made out of green people. It's just made out of, well, I guess maybe gangrene or whatever. They're rotting, right? And they're probably decomposing somewhat. I don't know. You're not supposed to eat an animal that's, like, died. You're only supposed to eat an animal that you've killed, that you've slaughtered, right? So if an animal dies of illness or even old age, it can be pretty dangerous to eat it.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, speaking of white, Apple drew most of their inspiration in the 2000s and 2010s from like the 60s and stuff, like those sensibilities of design and advertising. So, you know, when I watch a movie from the 70s or something like that, they always have really good like interior design. It's just interesting style. I don't know what that is. I'd like to pin it down to something that I can relate to, but I don't know if I can yet. And I think actually a lot of this was sort of not invented by our people anyway. What we were probably seeing was a burst of creativity from sort of a more Levant-influenced group, especially in advertising.
So what's your knowledge of Soylent Green then? Did you, when you were watching Futurama and they're making all those gags about Soylent Green, did you actually know what it was based on, what it was about?
I knew one thing and one thing only. Soylent Green is people.
Yeah, that's all you knew.
Yeah, it was like a surreptitious, like nobody knew it was made of people. And then at some point in the movie, someone yells in public, Soylent Green is people. And I mean, I was vaguely aware that there was an SNL sketch that was famous that did sort of a parody of this. I never saw that, though, either. I was just aware of that sketch. So this is, you know, I didn't even know Charlton Heston was the main character in this movie. And he gives a kind of a different performance from usual.
Yeah, he's quite good as a gumshoe, isn't he? He wasn't too bad, was he?
Yeah, I was impressed by his abilities. I think he actually got to flex a little bit more than he did, you know, in let's say, Planet of the Apes or even Ben-Hur. He's a little more stoic in those films. And here he's got a little bit more range than...
Well, you know Charlton Heston's a real man because he walks off a gunshot wound.
Yeah, there's a...
He gets shot in the leg and just walks it off, don't
Is that where Just Walk It Off comes from?
There was a lot of action in this movie. There was a lot of action that I wasn't expecting to see that. I was expecting to see more of kind of a thriller sort of thing, or instead what I got was something maybe closer to Minority Report with Tom Cruise, where there was a interstitial action between all of like the heady kind of dystopian sci-fi. And it's a stretch to call this sci-fi though. Right, it's quite a stretch.
Because what is he? He's a policeman, is he? It's just like the police can do whatever they want. They like go and steal stuff and beat people up, and there's no consequences.
Yeah, he's kind of a crooked cop. He's kind of not, because he exists within an entirely like destructive system. Like, this is clearly the end of the world. You know, everyone's in poverty and overpopulation. And oh wait, actually. So this is the biggest thing that got me, like, when I was watching this. This made me, like, blow up and start writing tons of notes while I was watching this, when they revealed, because, you know, I'm coming in not knowing anything about this story. This was made in, like, the early to mid-70s. And what do they reveal, like, about 20 minutes in? Global warming is the reason for Soylent Green. And in the movie, they call it the greenhouse effect still. So they haven't developed any kitschy, you know, euphemistic names yet, like, you know, climate change and climate crisis and all this bull crap. It's still just the greenhouse effect. And I mean, so wow.
The water system, is that knackered because the infrastructure is generally crumbling, or is it is there not much water to go round? They didn't really explain it in a big way, did they? But I assumed it was because the infrastructure was generally crumbling, because at one point they mentioned that they can't get new parts for things because they're not being made or something when they're talking about a lift.
My guess would be, how do you heat up water in your home, right? You probably are using some sort of fossil fuel to do that, right?
Well, I meant just drinking water, because they don't, there's no shortage of water, but there's no kind of plentiful supply of it either, is there?
I'm gonna guess it's just been completely polluted. It's just like air quality and water quality are just that bad. Like, regardless of global warming, because global warming doesn't necessarily pollute the water, right? It raises the acidity of the oceans, but that doesn't really matter for like fresh water or groundwater, that sort of thing. So the earth must just be so completely deranged and messed up. And they make several references to this, like nature just literally doesn't exist anymore, because it's nature is a myth by this point in the future, in 2022. The only person who remembers it is a Jewish man. He's the only person who remembers nature. And I want to get to that in a moment. But when they revealed that this movie was about global warming, to me, I needed to stop and look up who could be so retarded as to write a story like this. And I had an idea of who that might be. And of course, it was.
It could be the author. Have you ever read the short story?
This was based on a book called Make Room, Make Room.
Yeah, by Harry Harrison. It's the same author. Basically, he's not very good at doing about religion either. Because there's a short story called The Streets of Ashkelon, which is like a really poor, like, atheist tale.
Are you guys telling me that Soylent Green is based off Harry Harrison's work? Because I really like
Yes.
The Stainless Steel Rat by him. That's a good story. And Build a Galactic Hero. Oh, okay. Build a Galactic Hero and The Stainless Steel Rat. Two really good stories.
So what kind of politics does Harry Harrison have then, Hobbit, in your opinion, or do you not know?
I mean, he seemed pretty anti-war in Build the Galactic Hero, because there's this, I remember this bit in it, which is not pertinent to Soylent Green at all, where Bill has been press-ganged into the Navy, and his job is to replace these massive fuses they've got for the laser batteries, because occasionally they blow up and they need new fuses. But yeah, no, I mean, so Soylent Green is based on his stuff. In that case, I will definitely, I want to say I will definitely watch this film again to remind myself of it, but then I'm thinking to myself, but then that means you haven't seen the film. I've seen the film many years ago.
You saw it when it first came out, right?
Yes, I was there in the cinema. It's not quite, I think the ticket was only two and
six. You saw it with the projector, you could, like, it was like louder than the movie. Yeah. It's
not that you could see any of the film, because everyone's smoking in the cinema back then, in the before time.
Smoking cigars.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this was directed by Richard Fleischer. It was written, the stage play was written by Stanley Greenberg. And, you know, it's like, come on. right? Like,
old white males.
You just know before you look it up, right? And it hardly needs to be said. Since we did the global warming episode, it seems like a new story comes out every day that embarrasses these people. I just want to talk about that real quick, since global warming is the theme of Soylent Green. So it's absolutely relevant to discuss some of these things. So I wish that some of this stuff had come out when we were doing our episode on this, but things just move so quickly. Like, for example, we now think that sea levels will lower around the East Coast of America and Western Europe, including the UK, of course, because the gravitational pull of the northern ice caps in Greenland will cease to be as strong. So if the glacier that covers Greenland melts, then that massive, massive, massive piece of ice will no longer exert a gravitational force on the oceans around it, which raises the oceans at the moment. And any sea level rise effect that water has going into the ocean will be actually negated by the loss of the gravitational pull of the ice. So it's going to have the opposite effect. You know, when I've said to certain people in my daily life that, like, listen, this isn't going to affect America, you know. This is going to affect places that don't have good infrastructure or, like, you know, a robust civilizational capability. I get laughed at. Well, who's laughing now, Dad? No, I'm not talking about my dad.
You mentioned global warming, and I think it's pertinent considering the time in this film. You said it's 1973 it was released.
Talking about global cooling at the time, weren't they?
Well, that's the thing. So it's very interesting that they've switched.
They specifically talk about warming in this movie. Everything's hot. Like, they're talking about how air conditioning is such a luxury, so rare. Like, they say, let's make the air in here so cold like winters used to be.
Yeah, the scientific consent. What I was saying is the scientific consensus at the time that was that the planet was cooling, that we were heading for another ice age.
Let's be frank, there was never a scientific consensus ever. Okay,
I use scientific consensus in scare quotes, or should it be triple print?
The impact of the Holocaust is massive, but the facts about it are what some people would debate. The reason I mentioned
consensus on that, we have full consensus. 100%.
Oh,
damn it.
Oh, okay. No, I forgot.
I just don't want to see you locked in an underwater jail cell. That's all.
Yeah, that's true.
Below sea level.
But don't get me wrong. I'm not disputing the impact of it. Like I'm saying, I'm not disputing the impact of these claims is vast. I just want to say that now it seems from what I know about it, I'd say that we're due for global cooling. The sun's activity has reached I don't want to say what the time frame is, but it's very quiet, the sun.
Well, do you remember that article I found just after we did the global warming episode? Now, it said this was a 3-year-old article saying that global warming had ended 16 years before.
But I wanted to say was it was just a brief tangent saying that it's more likely that we'll have global cooling than warming in the future.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have global cooling. Sunglasses drop down. Deal with it. I also wanted to point out, it turns out that most of Greenland, the landmass of Greenland, is below sea level, sort of like the Netherlands. And if the ice caps there were to completely melt, they would form a massive lake that would be comparable to the Mediterranean Sea, about a third of the size of the Mediterranean Sea, and therefore would not affect sea levels much at all. So what we're going to be getting is a whole ton of new territory for the UK and the Eastern Seaboard of the United States. So thank you, global warming, and also a whole bunch of new oil for Russia and Canada. What can I say? Thank you, global warming. Just create a big puddle of gasoline outside right now and set it ablaze and have a big celebration, guys.
Well, to be honest, in mine and Hobbit's corner of the world, I think we're heading for global meh. Well, you don't really have a summer, you don't really have a winter, and you don't really have a spring or any other seasons. It's kind of like, it's just kind of miserable.
It's just like room temperature all the time.
Yeah, just global meh.
Sick. Just get rid of the roof on your house. Well, I mean, there will be rain, but yeah, you'll figure it out. Just put yourself in a glass dome. People in glass domes shouldn't throw stones or something. I don't know. We'll talk about glass domes in the next segment. Let's stop getting sidetracked.
It's good you're only doing two episodes, otherwise this would be a monster episode.
Yeah, right. All the dystopian elements in this film are not just about global warming, they're also a criticism of capitalism. So if global warming is such an attractive narrative for these people because it tells the story of Mother Nature herself subverting all the endeavors of European men, like saying, oh, well, you think you're so fancy with your Industrial Revolution. Whoa, you destroyed the whole planet with your hubris. Like, that's the narrative, right? It's some kind of weird, like, Old Testament gotcha moment for all of a European endeavor, right?
If we're talking about the global collapse, it's not really going to be a collapse. It's going to be a slide like this. I think in some ways it's kind of fairly clairvoyant as to what's going to happen, because this is the way it's going to be. It's just going to be countries groaning under the weight of their own populations, isn't it?
So one thing that really shook me was a moment in the... Actually, it was a few moments in the movie. When the main character expresses skepticism towards his older friends. Charlton Heston plays a detective, and he lives with another police officer. They're sort of like partners, but not in that way.
I think the book he was an ex-engineer. That's how they got the light bulb pushed.
Okay, well, he's another police officer who helps this detective with his investigations, and he's Jewish.
Analyst. There you go. He wasn't a cop, he was a police analyst. Yeah.
There you go. And he tells, and he's an older man, he's probably in his 60s or 70s or something like that, but he was alive during the Great Depression or something of that nature. Like he laments how badly the world is doing, just like, quote, when he was a boy. When I'm assuming he's referring to the Holocaust or the Great Depression. And he tells Charlton Heston about how great things used to be, how the world used to be beautiful with so much nature. And Charlton Heston expresses skepticism, and he thinks that he's just being a doddering old cynic. And so my big concern is that the world will continue to slide as it has, and future generations will just accept it as they do today. In fact, I think most people believe the world today is better than it ever was, and that just isn't true.
Well, that's kind of what the Strauss-Howe theory is all about, isn't it? Separating the generations, because if the generations don't have a proper dialogue, they won't know what happened before and what the world was like, will they?
Very true. No, that's very, very true. Listening to your elders and trying to understand their experiences is incredibly important. I think that we've sort of been programmed by, you know, propaganda from the 60s doesn't just extend to kind of the things that we often talk about.
That's what James Dean was like. You're just too square, daddy-o, isn't it? That's what that kind of stuff's all about, isn't it?
Right. Creating a generation gap, and sort of, you know, we have wars going on between the sexes. We have kind of like this push for equality and with things like busing and stuff that are kind of blurring lines that really should be quite clear. But we also have a war between generations that's been sort of manufactured for us. And again, we're sort of traipsing into territory from Logan's Run. So let's just backtrack a little bit and get into capitalism.
Yep.
Because the other pillar of this film is a criticism of capitalism. And I think, like, these people felt like they could take control of America the way they had taken Russia with the Bolshevik Revolution. Because keep in mind that even though they used criticism of the Soviet Union, even in this movie, by making references to things like breadlines in the USSR.
Did you notice how much the jam was? Or jelly, as you call it, wouldn't you know?
I did not. The strawberry?
$150 a jar.
But that woman, she's got a jam on the spoon. And is that where Charlton Heston's just watching her eating it?
Did she have it on a wooden spoon?
The spoon was on the table, and he kind of silently stole it and left the apartment just so that his Jewish friend could have a taste of it, because it is extremely expensive.
That's been in his pocket. Can you imagine all the fluff and stuff?
Yeah, how did he get it over there? That's kind of... That aside, I think it's less about price gouging and more that strawberries, because the whole agricultural system is just screwed because, you know, nature has been messed up.
There must be some kind of food network, isn't there? Because people are buying steak and they're buying jam and they're buying stuff like that, aren't they?
It's more of a... It's in very short supply. Very short supply. That's the point.
Yeah.
Like strawberries, there's so few strawberries on the planet compared to demand for it that they're going to cost $150.
There's plenty of lentils and soy. You know, sometimes I think to myself, it's not that the film is trying to be like realistic, like these are the realistic consequences of global warming. It's more a case of like, All these things you enjoy will be gone and you'll only have boring gruel to eat. To me, it does feel like it's very dogmatic. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but it sort of doesn't let facts get in the way of its narrative.
Yeah, but even the soy and lentils are gone, right? That's why Soylent Green is people and not plankton. Like they say that it's made out of plankton. That's why it's Soylent Green. Soylent Red, I believe, is maybe the lentils. And then Soylent Yellow, yeah. I think, is the soy. So Soylent Green is made out of plankton, or at least it's purported to be, when indeed we find out that it is, in fact, people. But I even though they do criticize the Soviet Union sort of in a way, I think that's just sort of to strike up fear, right? What they're really doing is sort of taking jabs constantly at the corporations who control everything.
Well, the Cold War was in full swing when this film was made, wasn't it? So it's a kind of average reference, really. It's not a special reference, is it, if you know what I mean?
Well, I think what they're doing is they're stirring up your biases against Soviet Russia while also simultaneously trying to start a Bolshevik style revolution in the US. I mean, it's crying out while they strike you. It's saying two things simultaneously. But in the end, they just took control of America with capitalism via the woke capital effect, right? Now we have, like, people unironically say capitalism with a conscience all the time now, right? So after sort of the introductory sequence of this movie, there is a shot amazingly similar and really practically identical to a shot in Blade Runner 2049, the new one with Ryan Gosling. The main character, who is a detective, is making his way up to his apartment after a long day of work and is pushing his way up a stairwell that's crowded with this multi-culti human detritus. And it's shot from the same angle on everything, tracking along Charlton Heston a little. I wonder how much of, like, the Blade Runner films were sort of lifted from, like, Soylent Green. Because there's a shocking number of similarities between the Blade Runner movies and Soylent Green, and Logan's Run, for that matter. So that's really interesting to me.
Yeah, I assume that Soylent Green has been a big influence on dystopian sci-fi, hasn't it? Because even it kind of, like, Charlton Heston's role reminds me of Mad Max's role in the original Mad Max film, because he's kind of a copper like that, where they don't appear to be part of the state, do they? But they still maintain law and order.
Yeah, you're right. I don't think detectives have a deep connection with the state in real life. They sort of are just doing their jobs. They report to their boss. And that's, I think, what Mad Max does in the original Mad Max. By the way, Mad Max 1 does not get enough credit. It actually has the best story out of all of them. And even though it may not have the cool design sensibilities of the later films, it actually is very interesting, especially compared to Fury Road, which is all glitz and no substance. But that aside,
you can imagine Mad Max being the Australian counterpart at the same time as Soylent Green, couldn't you, really?
There is a very similar story to there. And I always thought it was Mad Max Part 1 and Part 2. Like, Part 2 is just the collapse has happened and this is all that's left now. And you'll be eating bugs out of necessity.
That's what I was going to say earlier, was that if it was today, it would be Soylent Green is bugs.
Soylent Green is crickets. No, and then everyone would clap. And then everyone would clap, because that's, you know, I think what they would say instead of Soylent Green being plankton, they would claim it's crickets, and then they would find out that it's black people. Written by...
Okay, Jordan, if you're listening to this, there we go.
He's going to remake Soylent Green. Yeah, any second now. It's going to be like Soylent Black.
Here's a super important part of narrative I've got to bring in. Where did he get gravy from?
You can make gravy, bro.
But he cuts up the beef, it's in loads and loads of gravy, isn't it?
You can just make the gravy from the... you can use anything as a thickener, man. You probably could crush up Soylent Yellow, like the soy one. You could crush it up and make it into a thickener for the gravy. Come on. Wait,
are we turning into a soil?
I get a feeling that, again, facts are secondary to a narrative here.
By the way, I think this was before, like, corn became the food staple for the entirety of the West. You know, like high fructose corn syrup. I don't know if that was around yet in the 70s, but I mean, corn has become like the caloric staple of everything. And you would put cornstarch, like in the stew that I ate today, you know, I used cornstarch, rather my wife did, to thicken up the broth and stewify it, right?
I make Welsh rabbit that way. Well, I think we call it corn flour over here, but it is the starch from the corn. I mean, there's various ways of making Welsh rabbit, but one way, if you've got not a lot of cheese left, it's the pauper's way, is milk, you melt the cheese into it, and then you use flour or cornstarch to thicken it up, and you put that on toast.
Fucking delicious. All right. I want some Welsh rabbit very badly right now. So whenever these guys, they drink this white guy's alcohol that they swiped, they say L'chaim together. Colin Heth and his roommate shout L'chaim as they drink their stolen booze. That's fine.
Wait, is it me, or are they just deeply Jewish undertones to all Charlton Heston movies? Because Ben-Hur.
Right. We just talked about Ben-Hur, and there it is. I think that, I don't know, Charlton Heston is just very much into the post-war thing. Let's just put it that way. He was very much into the post-war idea of Hollywood, and that's just it. He's caught in that net. That's how it is. I mean, you could say Planet of the Apes was sort of the same thing. I think there's a very reasonable argument to be made for that. But as it pertains to Soylent Green, I think that reception to this movie was kind of, I looked into it a little bit, it was sort of an incredulous disbelief.
Well, I'm pleased that that was the response to it, because I may end up making this point multiple times during this review, but the director of this is Jewish, and never let facts get in the way of a good story seems to be something of a slogan for those type of directors. And all the sort of logical inconsistencies, like, well, why would soy be ready available and strawberries not? And then, oh, yeah, okay, never mind. But all these other sort of things, like water's hard to get hold of, air conditioning is scarce. It's all to try and sort of set a scene. And it's never really fought in terms of too concrete details, because all of those things, if you had somebody who actually knew how those systems worked, who actually worked in agriculture, you'd have something which I feel would be more authentic.
Well, you sort of believe the same things as the reviewers of the time, but I don't think you're going to like why. So the it's kind of interesting. The reason that there was a lot of disbelief around the story, that people weren't quite immersed in it, they thought that progressivism would never let things get worse. Surely the people would elect leaders that would have their best interests at heart. Surely, with so many people in extreme poverty, they would realize what's going on, rise up and correct the system. Surely feminism would only improve the lives of women and never the opposite of any of this.
Ah, but has not real feminism been tried yet?
Never been tried. Real proletariatism has never been tried. Real democracy has never been tried. We're just all fumbling through the dark on all of this. What we need is absolutely the DSA, of which I'm a proud member, to come in, to swoop in and collect this very sick society.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it wasn't for all those right-wingers stymieing the efforts of the progressives, we could have that utopia now.
Exactly. We would have our Black and Hispanic Space Marine Army if only continued colonialism was not keeping them down. So the ending was kind of underwhelming. I think people who watch this, who haven't seen it before, will be thinking about the famous line, Soylent Green is people the whole time. But then he says it, and the movie just quietly ends, and then Koyaanisqatsi Scotsy rolls behind the credits.
Let's play a little game then. What do you think happens to Charlton Heston after the credits? Do you think he's taken
Soylent
off to
Green.
A Soylent Green? Yeah.
Yes.
That's he's what I was going to say. Green do you think
now,
he's
obviously.
Taken off to a...
If I were back and look at it, I don't know if the director would be this clever, but maybe the people who take him away in a stretcher are probably sort of in the same uniforms and whatnot as the people taking corpses away to be processed. So I would wager, with the Soylent Corporation controlling everything, including the police, I don't think his boss, who's a gentleman that does not want to kind of go against the mold here, he was trying to convince Charlton Heston earlier in the film to falsifying a police report at the behest of the Soylent Corporation. So I really doubt that getting all this information from Charlton Heston is going to change his ways. I don't think there is going to be any kind of revolution or even, I don't think there will even be a emergence of these facts. Charlton Heston is just going to become foodstuffs, and that's it.
Speaking of, I was thinking of Sol's death, and like what you were saying about you shouldn't eat dead people. The fact is they poisoned Sol, didn't they? That thing he takes is obviously a poison, yet they still put him in the Soylent Green, don't they?
Wait, what? Okay. So yeah, the Jewish roommate, he decides that he wants to have his life ended early. And I guess there's sort of the kind of like Kevorkian style euthanization chambers where you can go and you can watch Koyani Skatsi as you're put to death in a peaceful and painless fashion.
The difference being the music's really nice in this one as opposed to Koyani Skatsi.
Yeah. Instead of the kind of Celtic chants or whatever.
Yeah, could you imagine? Imagine what that music would be today? It'd be some depressing fucking industrial techno.
Yeah. Well, and then Charlton Heston follows the cadaver of his friend to the processing plant. I don't really know where he gets this idea, to be honest. Like, why does he spontaneously do that? It occurred to me that there really wasn't a strong impetus given for that.
They don't really explain the two volumes of Oceanic Records, do they? They kind of skim over it.
Yeah, the hints are very, very minor. You know, part of the criticism that this movie got when it came out was that there was some decent action direction in it, but that, like, the story structure and everything was kind of crummy, kind of laughable. I tend to agree with that. I found that the story, the way it was portrayed, I mean, the story in most movies suck, but...
Oh, are you going to mention Charles, the doorman, when he does his bit of thought patrolling?
Before you Matt, just briefly about the story in this, when you're saying it sucks. I mean, the thing is, it's worse than that it sucks. It's not memorable. I saw the film about 5 or 6 years ago, and there's only half a dozen scenes I remember. Woman licking jam from a spoon. Soylent Green is
which didn't happen.
Oh, so I didn't remember that scene.
The Jewish guy licked.
The woman's eating the jam from the jar, isn't she? Yeah.
She was eating jam and leaves it on the table, and then Charlton Heston notices it, takes the spoon, and then gives it to his Jewish roommate who licks the jam.
I remember the suicide booth where he's in the cinema and he's smiling at the end of it. And I remember the people scoops as well. And that's about all of it. Oh, and also the architecture of the police hall was quite imposing. But apart from that, was it brutalist architecture? I'd have to watch it again. But I don't want to watch it again because the fact is it's an incoherent mess of a film.
Yeah, they don't really try to make it seem like the future. I think maybe they get some more high concept 70s interior design into some of the apartments, but it doesn't really feel like they don't do any like matte paintings or sets. They mostly just use urban. I think they just get some urban alleyways and such and film in there because everything looks mostly realistic.
I don't have a lot of actual scenery. A lot of it looked like sets to me.
I don't know. There was some pretty big set. They could have gone to Detroit. They could have gone to New York. They could have gone to Queens or Brooklyn, and they could have found those exact settings and filmed there. We'd have to look it up, but they had some pretty big outdoor areas. But I guess it is Hollywood.
I think this is still kind of the early days of, like, it's still the transition between. In some ways, it's still the transition between stage and film, isn't it?
Yeah, in a way. I think we're probably, at this point, we're probably about 40 years into it. But you're right. It does take time. We certainly were not getting massive CG, you know, backgrounds that are indistinguishable from reality. So there could have very well been enormous sets made for the city scenes or reused from other movies, etc.
Yeah.
So I think I would recommend this movie, all told. You know, it's pretty darn slow, but that's kind of a good thing because you can comfortably watch this at 2x speed in about 45 minutes, and you can get some interesting anti-industrial revolution insights that are not so common in films today.
The first time I watched this film was like a Sunday afternoon laying on the sofa kind of recovering kind of film, and I think that's kind of the film it is. It's a good film if you've got a hangover because it doesn't really require a lot of you, does it?
There you go. Yeah, you've got Brewer's Flu, then you can watch what happens when eventually we all become third worlders, because that's totally the way it works, right? As is the premise of our next film, Logan's Run. So this is the same kind of premise as Soylent Green. The earth was ruined by overpopulation and pollution, except in this setting, everyone's living in like a sealed off glass dome that has been turned into a paradise.
There's some lovely like miniature sets in this, isn't there? There's real nice panning shots of the outside of the city and stuff like that, isn't there?
That's the first thing you really notice, is that you do get some almost convincing miniatures that they didn't really need to do, but I think they chose to for aesthetic reasons. And it does give you a much more broad sense of the world they're in. I think it really, really, really adds to it. And one thing they don't explain so well is that automation has turned this world into a paradise. So unlike Soylent Green, which is this takes place in this super ghetto, not quite unlike Judge Dredd in a way, or Blade Runner, these people live in a sparkly, squeaky clean paradise. However, the way that they maintain this apparently is through boomer genocide. So when a character turns 30, they're just killed off.
The lack of multiculturalism, I thought that's why everything was so squeaky clean.
Everyone is white. Perhaps that's why they lack compassion. So maybe if they weren't so white, they wouldn't be killing people for entertainment. They'd all be twerking happily or something like that.
Eating Soylent Green on the street.
Exactly. Well, this is great. This touches upon something I wanted to note, is that one real insidious part of institutionalizing equality is that if you can convince people that they are perfectly capable of themselves being third worlders, you can spook them into almost any behavior, like the ones in Logan's Run. Childlessness, debauchery, and not quite so much in happening in Logan's Run, but I thought open borders is one aspect of this as well. Now, Logan's Run is exactly the opposite of open borders. It's a totally self-contained system, which is fine too. It's just, you know, the way they do it is that automation and AI have convinced them to do some really evil things.
Do you think this film informed Demolition Man? Because Demolition Man seems almost like an update of like Logan's Run society, doesn't it? With the hookup culture.
Demolition
and stuff
Man?
Like that. Yeah, you know the way they hook up with the brain machines and things like that. I'm sure, isn't that what they do?
Are you thinking of the movie? Because Demolition Man is the one with Sylvester Stallone and Wesley Snipes.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's how you have sex. That's how you have sex in.
Okay. So I don't think so. Like, there, it's kind of interesting because first I want to explain who the main character is. He's another kind of police officer.
He's a Sandman.
Right, called a Sandman. So we're seeing this in Soylent Green, Blade Runner, Logan's Run, and there's a trend here of dystopian movies where our link to the world is a person who upholds the status quo and then realizes the error of his ways. Minority Report also. This is like
Equilibrium.
A very, very common
Equilibrium's
film.
Equilibrium.
Equilibrium. There you go. There you go. I mean, in a way, The Matrix is sort of brave for... not brave. I mean, that's too strong of a word, but Matrix is different in the way that it has someone who's kind of a rebel already becoming more of a rebel. In all these other movies, they have someone who is the opposite of a rebel becoming one. So I mean, this could be considered enlightened or subversive. I guess it depends on who is making the point and why.
The only difference here is Logan doesn't do it himself, though, does it? He's shoved into it by the computer, isn't he?
Yeah, that's an interesting twist where you see that the computer sends him on a secret mission to reveal some rebels. And actually, there's quite a few twists. There's quite a few twists. I don't even know if I want to talk about the twists, because they kind of subvert your expectations once and then do it again. And then the computer becomes so confused that it blows up the entire dystopian society. It just blows itself up from being so confused. Like, I've seen this in Futurama where like they would recite a paradox to a robot and then the robot blows up, and I know that's a reference to classic sci-fi, but here it like literally happens, so that's really, really funny.
If you watch these two films, you'll get a whole heap of
I grew up reading a lot of Isaac Asimov stories, and the idea of like one of the paradoxes is all lawyers are liars, I am a lawyer. And it destroys this computer. It's responsible for life support on this hostile planet.
That's a good
idea. Right. You just say to a robot, this statement is a lie, and then it will destroy itself. And I think like the Santa robot in Futurama has like an anti-paradox chip or something like that to correct itself. But I think part of the reason they make these people police officers is that in a way, through someone who upholds the law, you kind of get to see the standard lifestyle, like someone who's a little bit above a pleb, but not quite as above the rich, yet has both of those groups within his grasp, like within reach. That's how you get to get a full view of the lifestyle of the society.
I think it's more like these people follow the rules and enforce the rules rigidly, but look at this Naxalt.
But you get to see people who break the rules. So therefore, you get to see why they break the rules and empathize with them. And you get access to people who establish the rules. So you get to see the elite and whatnot, right? So to get an insight into the lifestyle of Logan's Run, it's a society dedicated entirely to pleasure, and they actually predict Tinder in this movie. So the character literally uses a 3D Tinder where he can summon, like, sort of like the teleporter or the, what do they call it? The transporter in Star Trek, you know, beam me up, Scotty. This guy has one in his living room.
Well, this is where you see the one slight amount of pause in this film, isn't it? Because doesn't Jenny Agutter say, oh, is that from Logan's Run?
No. You're getting a little bit reversed. So what happens like people can kind of volunteer themselves to be beamed into other people's homes. And so what you see is like a box where people are getting beamed into this guy's box in his home. And first he has a man beamed in. And then he's like, no. And he skips forward. So he's basically swiping left on a dude, right? I mean, you'd think that you could put in your preferences beforehand, but whatever. They're just shoehorning that in. And then, and then a woman gets beamed in. And so he's like, all right. And he opens up the door. And then she's like, actually, I don't know. Never mind. And it turns out she doesn't like him because he's a cop, right? Because he's a Trump supporter. And he's like, whoa. Do you prefer women? I know they don't give us options for this. So do you actually prefer women? Right? And then he just finds out, like, he's a Trump supporter. So that's why she doesn't want to sleep with him. So, yeah. But you know what? On the whole, I think that this movie is actually more moral and less subversive than Soylent Green. So the debauchery and even the homosexuality is sort of framed in the context of an evil society. Right? But there are parts where it's subversive.
Oh, he's like that, isn't he? He's like, it was also nice to see an appearance from Farrah Fawcett as well.
Is that the blonde?
The famous pinup from the 70s. The blonde that works in the face changing salon.
Okay, so yeah, you get like instant plastic surgery. Like, that's another debaucherous thing. You can have like instant plastic surgery on your whole body. And there is a woman who's a really cute lady, apparently she was a model. Okay, I know the name Farrah Fawcett. I did not recognize that woman as Farrah Fawcett. I just thought she was hot. So that's cool. I didn't know there was a cameo there. And it really is just a cameo. She's only in the movie for a couple scenes. That's pretty neat. But the subversive points come in when anyone questions the status quo. And they're always like, hey, do you ever think that our normal and happy society is like bad? And then the other characters are just like, ha ha, what a crazy statement you just made. And the audience is supposed to empathize and be like, whoa, if those people are wrong, then maybe, you know, people who question like our society, like, are right. You know, people who are like, oh, well, what are those NAMBLA people that are parading through the streets? What if they're actually right? You know, in that way, subversive.
Well, I've just had a look in the book. Last day is 21, not 30 in the book. In the book, last day, you know, when they have to go and die, it's 21 in the book, not 30.
Okay, which puts so I guess they thought it, doesn't it? Maybe that was yeah. I mean, I could see why they would change that specifically for a film, because, like, come on, people in like their teens and 20s are not good actors. Like, look at Hunger Games. Right? Like, Jennifer Lawrence does not give like an insanely good performance there. I mean, to be frank, you know, the performances in Logan's Run are not that fantastic either, but I could see how they would be even worse if you tried to actually cast like someone in their early 20s or
it doesn't make sense for the society wouldn't really be able to run properly because no one really matures enough to be able to do anything, do they?
Well, that's what I was thinking about the movie itself anyway. Like, 20-year-olds are really not very good at stuff. But, you know, it doesn't matter. Everything's automated, remember?
Yeah.
Did that episode of Star Trek with all the boys in it come out before Did that come out before Logan?
One I'm not familiar with that one.
Star Trek episode where everyone's young and they turn like into a feral animal when they mature, when they go through puberty.
Yeah, so they kill all the people that go pubescent.
Yeah, that was before Logan's Run. That would have been in the 60s, right? Whereas Logan's Run came out in 1977.
Yeah, Star Trek was 66. Logan's Run, I think, was 76. So I would have thought, did Star Trek run for about 10?
Only 3 seasons. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's, they're very far apart. They're very far apart. I mean, there's lots of different, this kind of story trope where everyone's a child is not.
Well, Children of the Corn's a similar story, isn't it?
Also, The Time Machine, where he goes into the future and everyone is sort of childlike, right? So, it actually doesn't matter in Logan's Run how old or young people are because everything is run by AI, like literally everything, and people only live to have sex and whatnot. I think it might be a little more controversial, especially, 40, 50 years ago, to have like these orgy chambers and have people's tits out when they're only like 20. You know, if they were to do that kind of thing, like if people are too young, like having these orgies, because there is quite a bit of nudity in the film, and gratuitous nudity at that. And there are scenes of like orgy chambers. They're not that explicit. Everything is semi-inferred. But still, I think if they were to say like, oh, these people are potentially 14, that could be a little dicey. Maybe not today. Well, no, actually, you probably could do that today. Give it 10 years and I think it'll be perfectly acceptable, but don't hold me to that. But still, I think that that's probably why they pushed it up a little bit. That's what I suspect. So at one point, the main characters wander upon the ruins of Washington, D.C., where they see all the landmarks and they're like, whoa, past people had awesome stuff. Actually, this is pretty cool. We see the Lincoln Memorial. We see the Capitol building and they're just like, whoa, this is cool. What's this portrait of this guy? Apparently he never told a lie. Wow. I think it would have been like really neat if they had actually gone outside of the historical government area of Washington, D.C. And you like, you see all the crappy ghettos and stuff, which actually comprise like most of D.C. It's like one of the worst cities in America. Like you can see photos. Like in real life, you can see photos of the Capitol building in the background, which is like a beautiful structure designed exclusively by British men. And then it's juxtaposed with a homeless black man in a rotting ghetto in the foreground. It's supposed to be like, Congress is only right over there and they're ignoring all the poverty around them, all the needs of the people around them. It's just very, very, very subversive. And it really tells a lie.
You could do it now as kind of a juxtaposition, couldn't you, with the nice and shiny bit that's built over the ghetto areas, ignoring the political area.
Yeah. Yeah. With gentrification in a way. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could do that with New York City, where you could see like subway trains from like the 70s, and they're all like graffitied, like people, just gross people on them. And then today, where it's like most of it has been gentrified, at least in most of like Manhattan and the areas surrounding Manhattan. So yeah, it's like trying to say, like these dystopian films try to say that we've lost our compassion as a society. We've turned people into disposable objects. I mean, Logan's Run especially, right? But also Soylent Green, where we're now, we've turned to cannibals. At least in Soylent Green, it's justified that we're taking people who have already died and we're eating them. Honestly, that's not even as bad as slaughtering people daily for no purpose really whatsoever, other than to maintain this closed system. You even think that the world outside of the Logan's Run city is destroyed. But no, it's like perfectly livable. It's like, why did they even put themselves inside of a dome? Because Washington, D.C. just looks like a campground. Like, it looks perfectly livable. There are even cats there. Like, cats live there.
Do you think the runners, do you think they're kind of a bit like the Matrix, where it's kind of an allowed escape valve? Because they never get anywhere, because they usually run into that robot with the ice robot that ices people up. I didn't know whether that was something worth.
No, that's just a twist on top of a twist. I don't think this is like an.
Well, the AI knows it's going on, doesn't it? Because it sends.
They have a similar theme in Brave New World, where there's a savage sanctuary, But people that don't fit into the society, they live like this in relative squalor.
And you're supposed to think that such a society exists in Logan's Run, when in fact it does not. And that is the paradox. Like, the AI, I mean, the ending of this movie, I gotta say, is really stupid. I said I didn't want to spoil it, but I just want to talk about the ending here. It's like, the AI thought that there was a secret rebel stronghold that was trying to subvert their society. And all Logan says is like, nope, it's not real. The AI is able to scan his brain, confirm he's not lying. And the AI, so full of itself, is like, I can't possibly be wrong. And then it blows up. And the entire friggin' city blows up.
It's like, is the AI an analog for Hillary Clinton then, is it? You know, I can't possibly be wrong.
Well, if that's the case, I mean, then simply us telling people the truth would have brought down, you know, all the crap we're dealing with instantly, right? And I think a lot of us felt it would, but in...
Did the AI later bring out a book that said it wasn't its fault?
Right. It's not my fault. It's the fact that runners are too lazy. I don't know. They're too lazy to start a rebel stronghold. Yet another runner lie. You know, you try to tell people about how society is disposing of them. And typically, the kind of response you get is very similar to the response in Logan's Run. Because when Logan, he stands in front of, like, the whole population of the city as they're heading towards the nightly death ceremony. And he says, hey, guys, Logan's Run is people. No, wait. He says to them that nobody gets renewed. Nobody gets reincarnated, which is what they all believe. They believe people are getting, they have some chance of being reincarnated when they die. And they all laugh at him. And they don't believe that there's a world outside of their city that's livable and beautiful. They just think he's crazy. They just think he's a joker or a nut or just misguided, when in fact it's the truth. And all he needed to do was tell the truth, and then the whole system destroyed itself. But that's not how it works in reality. In reality, when you tell the truth, you're demonized, you're suppressed, and in certain cases, you are destroyed. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't continue to fight. Because once enough people shout the truth, and we are all shouting it in unison, we'll be able to drown out these lies. I want to remind all of our listeners that you're doing the right thing, and you are a good person. I'm proud to be associated with all of you today. Now just remember that. And until next time, stay dope. People running by me out the city lights, just like the way.